I'm Phil Picardi. It's Friday, July 31st, the final day of the month. It's the NPR News Update. This podcast goes away next week. Starting Thursday, you can get all of the NPR News from a new podcast called The Ticker. You can find it on our website or iTunes. Today on the podcast, people of color assess the job being done by Minneapolis police. We hear about a Minneapolis police officer who does his job really well, too well, according to some. Should the state legislature convene to help Mille Lacs resorts? We learn about the fate of Swedish immigrants moved out of an area of St. Paul decades ago. And a Twin Cities photographer veers from his intended path. First, the Minneapolis man suspected of war crimes connected with an Eastern European Nazi SS unit during World War II is unlikely to be prosecuted. Tim Nelson has more.
A Munich prosecutor says Michael Karkotz isn't fit for trial. The 96-year-old retired construction worker became the subject of a war crimes investigation after an amateur investigator based in London claimed Karkotz had been the same man that commanded a Ukrainian SS unit near the end of the war. The Associated Press said the unit was suspected of civilian massacres in two villages in what was then Poland in 1943 and 1944. The unit may also have helped suppress the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. Karkotz immigrated to the U.S. after the war. He has never addressed the charges in person, although his family has denied the accusations. The AP says Karkotz's attorney blocked a medical exam by German authorities, but that they believe records from the U.S. indicate his health would prevent his extradition and trial. The German prosecutor says the case is unlikely to proceed any further. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A federal bankruptcy judge has rejected a request to push back to next year a deadline for sex abuse victims to file claims against the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Martin Moylan reports.
The judge said extensive notice of next Monday's deadline had been given by the Archdiocese and through the media and other channels. And he said bankruptcy law permits someone truly unaware of the deadline to file a late claim. Archdiocese attorney Richard Anderson said an extension was unnecessary and would have slowed resolution of the bankruptcy, increased legal fees, and created confusion.
We've made extraordinary efforts and have provided an extraordinary level of notice.
More than 260 persons have filed claims alleging sex abuse. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Education Committee chairs in the Minnesota House and Senate say they want to hold hearings on issues raised in the latest round of statewide testing. Tim Pugmire has more.
The results of the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Test show reading scores held steady, math scores dipped by a percentage point, and science scores were stagnant. The results again highlighted persistent achievement gaps. Republican House Education Chair Jennifer Loon said the status quo is failing the next generation, and she wants to consider all educational reforms that could remedy the problem. DFL Senate Education Chair Chuck Wieger said the test results show there is more work to do to help students move forward. Both lawmakers are planning committee hearings before next year's legislative session. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Starting tomorrow, drivers who repeatedly text while driving will face a higher fine. Laura Ewan reports.
Under the new law, drivers will still pay $50 for their first offense, but $275 on second and subsequent violations. Matthew Riggs lost his younger brother, David, who was struck on his scooter 2 years ago by a driver who had been texting. Riggs says he rushed home from his deployment in Afghanistan after he heard the news.
So I'm laying in the hospital bed, and I knew that was the last time I was going to see him. So obviously the long-term impact of this careless crash was that our lives are changed forever.
Riggs says the incident forced him to examine his own driving habits. Over the past 5 years in Minnesota, nearly a fifth of all traffic fatalities and serious injuries were related to distracted driving. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton is getting some pushback on his plan to call a special session to help businesses near Lake Mille Lacs. Dayton is holding a town hall meeting in Isle today to talk about what happens if walleye fishing season is forced to close early next week. But as Tom Scheck reports, some Republicans in the legislature say they don't think a special session is necessary.
The Department of Natural Resources says it may have to close walleye fishing on the popular lake next week. That's prompted worry among Mille Lacs resort owners that their business will collapse. And even though most legislators agree that the walleye situation on Mille Lacs is dire, they aren't convinced about the need for a special session.
The suggestion of a special session is a little premature.
Republican Representative Tom Hackbarth of Cedar is the chair of the House Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee. He says he thinks the state should look at alternatives, including promoting other fishing options on the lake and catch and release requirements for walleye. Hackbarth also said he isn't convinced the DNR should be shutting down walleye fishing on Mille Lacs at all.
Maybe we can get past this without closing the season. And that would take care of a lot of the economic problems that they're having in the area if we kept the season open. How critical is it that we close it right now? Maybe we don't need to do that.
DNR officials have maintained that young fish aren't surviving in the lake. They say the only way to rebuild the walleye population is to restrict the number of fish that can be taken from the lake. Instead of immediately calling a special session, Hackbarth says he thinks a bipartisan working group should be formed to discuss options. Republican Senator Brandon Peterson of Andover says he doesn't think a special session should be called at all. Peterson said he sympathizes with the plight of resort owners on Mille Lacs, but he said it's not the role of state government and the taxpayers to rescue them.
In terms of providing economic, financial assistance, while I understand the need that many people may have, I think if you go down that road, you're gonna induce probably a cattle call from a bunch of different corners of the state.
DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach agrees a working group should be formed to discuss the walleye situation on Mille Lacs, but he also supports Governor Dayton's call for a special session. Bach disagrees with the notion that state government should not help area businesses. He said the legislature helps other industries, including taconite workers on the Iron Range, farmers, and turkey producers.
When the state closes the fishing season and businesses are impacted, we're creating the less volume in business traffic. So I think you got some obligation.
Bach says the details of public assistance have to be worked out, but it could likely include zero interest loans, tourism promotion, and property tax relief. Governor Dayton also defended the idea of providing state help to resort owners. A recent economic survey of Mille Lacs County showed 22% of the workforce is in the leisure and tourism industry. That's second only to education and health services. Dayton says he's committed to looking at every way possible to help area businesses.
I'm not willing to give up on either the lake or the businesses who depend upon the lake for their livelihood until we've made every effort. I intend to see that we make every effort over the next month's time.
Dayton said the earliest he could call lawmakers back for a special session would be next week. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
If you live in a high-crime neighborhood in Minneapolis, it's not unusual to see police officers conducting traffic stops and arrests. That's led to tensions between the police and some people of color who say they are being targeted by officers. Brant Williams talked to African Americans on the city's north side and reports how they view the way police fight crime.
About a half dozen kids play catch with a Nerf football on a grassy vacant lot in the Jordan neighborhood on a pleasant summer evening. Nearby, a group of volunteers from the Jordan Area Community Council are serving free chicken wings, French fries, and potato salad to residents who stop by and take brief surveys. Jordan typically has more reported robberies, burglaries, and assaults than many other parts of the city. Nearly half of residents are African American, the largest racial or ethnic group in the neighborhood. Some black residents, like Alvin McCoy, say the presence of police is a fact of life around here. And he says officers don't bother or harass him.
I don't wear my pants sagging. I look like I'm finna do what I'm doing, going to work, going home. That's what I do.
Yeah.
So I ain't bothering nobody, la-di-da-di.
But others here say officers who patrol North Minneapolis are too aggressive. Johnny Lane says last year police pulled him over and ticketed him for driving without a license. He says officers towed his car and made him walk home, which was just a few blocks away. Lane says he believes officers pulled him over just because he's black.
They said something about I been through a complete stop at the stop sign. That was just a big lie.
Over a nearly three-year period, people arrested by Minneapolis police for low-level offenses were nearly nine times more likely to be black or Native American than white. Officers made more arrests in North Minneapolis than in any other part of the city. And often the people arrested here also call the North Side home, according to an NPR News analysis of police arrest data. That presents a number of challenges for a police department trying to improve its relationship with people of color. Inspector Mike Friesleben, commander of the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis, says officers need the community to help them fight crime. But he says people are reluctant to cooperate if they feel like officers unfairly stop them for minor offenses. Friesleben says he encourages officers, whenever possible, to explain why they stop someone and apologize if they get the wrong person. And he says he wants the public to understand why the police do what they do.
If we pull you over and we think it's a suspicious deal and it's not, and you think you're getting pulled for no reason, and then you get attitude or you get volatile, it just, one thing leads to another. Now we have this negative contact, where if everyone just keep their cool, we can have a positive contact.
I have a good relationship with the 4th Precinct, with the Inspector Friesleben and his officers.
Clinton Collins has lived in North Minneapolis for 14 years. He's an attorney and chairman of the board of the Minneapolis Urban League. Collins, who is black, says officers on the north side are more savvy and less likely to engage in racial profiling than in the past. But he understands why some African Americans still fear and distrust police.
There has been a history that's been checkered. And there have been some cops that engaged in inappropriate behavior. There have been some bad cops. But on the other hand, there have been some bad actors as well.
Collins says in his neighborhood, those bad actors are usually young black men. And he's critical of people who protest against what he calls excessive policing, but don't live on the north side. But there are north siders who think they are being over-policed. Carrie Jo Felder is African American and a member of the group Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. Like Felder, many members of the group live in North Minneapolis and often speak out against police misconduct. Felder says officers sometimes cast too wide a net when they're looking for crime suspects. Felder says one night last month, she and members of her family were sitting on the front porch of their home when officers drove by slowly and flashed a bright spotlight in their faces.
That means, like, you can't just hang out on your own porch on the property that your family owns, you know, without having suspicion or, you know, just a nasty feeling cast your way.
Felder says she's also had officers' flashlights in her face while she's driving. She says she called to complain about it, but was told the officers were just doing their job. Police Chief Janae Harto has said she wants her officers to have a noticeable presence in neighborhoods where the most serious crimes are reported, but she doesn't want them there just to make a bunch of arrests.
I don't put officers there with the expectation of enforcement. I put officers there with the expectation of being in the area. And that means engaging in the community, that means walking a footbeat, that means having conversations with people, that means being visible, being present, being engaged.
Back in the Jordan neighborhood, Cy Jones sits on his front steps watching residents gather in the vacant lot down the block. Jones is black and moved to the north side from Chicago 15 years ago. He says the neighborhood needs police. He just doesn't want them to discriminate against the majority of people who live in the area.
You know, you see a couple of African-American young men in the car. They might be carpooling, going to work just like, you know, some other ethnic groups. You know, but if they look like they're trouble and if they break the law, I mean, you got to uphold the law. That's your job. Do your job.
Minneapolis police leaders say they will keep up the patrols on the north side and anywhere violence spikes. So far this year, Minneapolis is experiencing an uptick in shootings and homicides. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The Minneapolis Police Department has come under scrutiny for its low-level arrests ever since an ACLU analysis found African Americans were far more likely to receive citations than whites. But the data also show another kind of disparity. One police officer in particular handed out about twice as many of those citations as any other. Curtis Gilbert has the profile of Michael Killebrew and the controversial approach to police work he exemplifies.
The vast majority of Minneapolis cops issued fewer than 200 misdemeanor citations during the nearly three-year period the ACLU studied. Only 14 officers cracked 1,000. Killebrew stood far above even that elite group. he cited and arrested more than 2,000 people. Killebrew's assignments over the last few years lent themselves to writing lots of tickets. He was freed from dealing with day-to-day 911 calls and was tasked with proactively patrolling for crime. But that only tells part of the story. As the numbers show, Killebrew is clearly unique. Steve Gallagher runs the Stephen Square Community Organization, and he says Killebrew is one of the best and most diligent cops he's ever worked with. Gallagher used to jokingly warn his neighborhood watch volunteers not to jaywalk on patrol because Killebrew would write them up for it.
He was very consistent on if you broke the law, then you would get a ticket. He didn't care if you're what race or creed or sex you were. He was very fair to everyone. He would give everyone a ticket or let them know that they were doing wrong.
Killebrew rarely gives warnings. That's something Tamira Robinson learned firsthand.
Never a warning. A warning would be next time have this done and you won't get told.
Police pulled Robinson over a lot when she lived in North Minneapolis. She was cited repeatedly for not having a valid license or insurance card. Killebrew caught her multiple times and had her car impounded twice. When she spotted his cruiser circling a parking lot in August, she figured he was after her again. So she pulled out her cell phone and trained it on his car.
Come on, police. Come on, bitch. You want to harass? Let me show you how to harass.
Now Robinson says she's got her license and insurance up to date, and she's moved to St. Paul, in part to get away from Officer Killebrew.
Being a single parent on disability isn't enough money to afford the tickets that he wants to give and the tows he's doing.
Killebrew's citations run the gamut from littering to loitering, but he has a special talent for traffic stops. Unlicensed and uninsured drivers received more tickets from Killebrew than any other type of violator. He wrote close to 800 citations for lack of auto insurance, and Roberta England is glad he did. England runs the Falwell and Weber Camden neighborhood associations in North Minneapolis, and she says uninsured drivers are a huge problem in her part of the city.
One of the biggest aggravations and fears of residents is when they are in an accident and it turns out that the automobile is uninsured and the driver may not be licensed. Then the burden of the repair falls exclusively to the victim.
England has worked with Killebrew for years. She describes him as a quiet cop with a wicked sense of humor. She says he's also incredibly observant and good at spotting crime.
I believe that he is the kind of cop for a conflicted neighborhood. I couldn't say that if I thought that he was directing his police tactics towards a particular race of people. And I don't believe Killebrew does that.
About 70% of the people Killebrew ticketed were black. That's higher than the department-wide average of 60%. But for about half the time period covered in the report, Killebrew was assigned to the city's north side, which has the highest minority population in Minneapolis. In addition to leading the city in low-level citations, Killebrew has also advocated publicly for giving police more tools to stop potential criminals. He frequently teaches community group volunteers how to make citizens' arrests. And in 2006, he even crafted a proposed ordinance that made it to the Minneapolis City Council. Don Samuels chaired the Public Safety Committee back then.
Amending Title 15, Chapter 385. Relating to offenses miscellaneous, in general prohibiting use of alleys.
Killebrew's proposal would have made it illegal for pedestrians to walk down alleys unless they lived on the block or had some official reason for being there. At the time, Killebrew told the Star Tribune he was always chasing criminals down alleys. But some residents, including Susan McCallum, warned the council the proposed ordinance would lead to more racial discrimination.
In your hearts, you know that somebody who looks like me is not going to get stopped in an alley. But if I weren't so white, and I weren't middle-aged, and I weren't a woman, somebody who saw me would call and say there's some person who's going to do bad in the alley.
The council ultimately agreed with that point of view and voted down Killebrew's proposal. More recently, it repealed ordinances banning spitting and lurking with the intent to commit a crime, also over concerns about racial profiling. A spokesman for the Minneapolis Police Department said Killebrew didn't want to participate in an interview. But the department turned over his personnel file in response to an open records request. Law enforcement is actually Killebrew's second career. Prior to joining the force, he spent 21 years in the Army, retiring as a sergeant. He served in the First Gulf War and is also trained as a licensed practical nurse. He turned 60 this year. Many officers retire at 55 or even earlier. Killebrew's personnel file is full of commendations for his high level of productivity, positive attitude, and communication skills. He was named 5th Precinct Officer of the Year in 2007, and last year, he won the Chief's Award of Merit for the second time. His current commander and former partner, Inspector Mike Friesleben, says Killebrew's work ethic makes him stand out.
We're very lucky to have him. He's just a very hardworking, polite officer, and very seldom do we hear really any complaints about him.
There have been 18 complaints against Killebrew. Not a huge number, considering he's served 19 years in the department. Recently, though, he's seen an uptick in complaints. 7 were filed in the last year and a half. But all the internal investigations concluded Killebrew did nothing wrong. He's never been disciplined. In spite of that, Minneapolis NAACP President Nakima Levy-Pounds says Killebrew's record raises red flags.
I'm not saying that this guy is a bad person. I don't know him. But I do have concerns about how he is utilizing his authority as an officer.
Levy-Pounds says a zero-tolerance approach to low-level offenses leaves residents feeling persecuted, especially Black residents, because there's a heavier police presence in neighborhoods where they live. It's an approach to policing sometimes called the broken windows theory. The idea is that little problems in neighborhoods, like windows that don't get repaired, lead to bigger problems, like violent crime. But Levy-Pounds doesn't buy it. She says broken windows policing does more harm than good.
When you begin to crack down on low-level offenses, petty offenses, minor offenses, you actually create a whole new set of problems because people wind up in the criminal justice system who otherwise would not have a criminal history.
Lieutenant Bob Kroll sees it differently. He's the president of the Minneapolis Police Officers Federation, and he argues attacking small crimes can help prevent bigger ones.
You stop that person for jaywalking. If he was not jaywalking and you didn't have cause to stop him, maybe you wouldn't realize that he has a warrant for his arrest for narcotics.
Steve Gallagher from the Stevens Square Community Organization says that approach is working for his neighborhood. He's seen the difference it's made at his group's annual meetings.
About 8 years ago, the biggest complaints were prostitution, drug arrests, and open drinking, loitering in the streets. This last year during annual meeting, our biggest complaint was parking and traffic issues. It's a huge change in our neighborhood, and I put that directly in the Minneapolis Police Department and their broken window theory.
Gallagher says Killebrew deserves part of the credit. He worked in the area for most of that time period. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto doesn't advocate a broken windows approach. She prefers community policing, where officers are encouraged to have positive interactions with residents, not just enforce the law. Killebrew recently got a new assignment. The department moved him to a unit that focuses on a relatively small number of problem rental properties. He's no longer tasked with proactively patrolling the streets. So these days, Killebrew isn't making as many arrests as he used to. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A unique archaeology project is just getting underway in St. Paul. University of Minnesota graduate students are hoping to unearth details of the city's immigrant past, long buried in Swede Hollow, along a creek east of downtown. Shacks stood there for more than a century before the city cleared them out, and unlike other projects, these archaeologists are inviting the public to experience the dig firsthand.
My name is Stephanie Kowalczyk. I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota in the anthropology department. We are in Swede Hollow Park right now, so you're in East St. Paul, and you're along Phalen Creek. That's what you see right behind you. So they're digging a shovel test, and that is a really good way that us as archaeologists can sort of survey and take kind of an initial feeling for what is happening. So all you do is you dig a hole about anywhere from 35 to like 50 centimeters around. We send them through a screen, so that's quarter inch mesh, so the dirt gets screened through there. Anything that looks like it could be an artifact or historic, we save.
Ooh, pretty.
No.
Somebody's stained glass.
Get excited about.
The hollow was burned by the city of St. Paul in 1956 because it was deemed a health hazard. So what we're looking for is to try to find that burn layer in the soil. This way we can date anything that comes after that.
Got a big bone.
I'm Kelly Wolf. I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota studying cultural heritage management in the anthropology department.
styrofoam.
The written record doesn't necessarily give us a day-to-day story. If you think about your trash can, what do you throw away every day? Your food remains, wrappers from packaging and different things like that. And so think of those types of things in a historic context. What are they leaving behind? A broken plate or a broken vase or something like that. And so those are the things that we'll see.
Ooh, rusty metal, my favorite.
This area way back was sometimes a pass-through for Native Americans as they headed to central Minnesota. So the Swedish immigrants started coming here in the 1850s. They would come in first on the river and then by train, and they would be dropped off at the St. Paul Depot and walk the train tracks down into the hollow. And then once they got here, they basically moved into the first open shack that they found. By the 1900s, more Italian immigrants started coming through, and the Swedish immigrants started moving up onto the bluff. Following that, there was more Mexican immigrants coming in. They were coming in the 1930s. At its peak, there was maybe upwards of 2,000 people. Towards the end, there was about 50 to 100.
We're out here Friday through Monday this week and next week. And the public is invited to come out, take a quick tour, ask some questions, kind of look over our shoulders, see what we're doing. Fridays and Saturdays, the public's invited to come out. But this time, if you've ever wanted to be an archaeologist, you get to try. We will show you how to sketch the unit, how to excavate, how to measure, how to take photos. People can maybe walk away with a better understanding of archaeology and not think dinosaurs or Indiana Jones.
St. Paul-based Alex Soth is an internationally known photographer. Yet, like many artists nowadays, a lot of his work is about collaboration and basic human interaction. UNCARE reports on two projects where Soth started with pictures and ended up with something else.
Most people take pictures to capture a moment or a memory, to create a dramatic image. Alex Soth is no exception. But recently, in a project called Disappear With Me, he used photographs to offer a unique experience.
To create some sort of dialogue with an individual in which they're, you know, purchasing pictures that disappear.
Disappear With Me was one of the offerings in the Walker Art Center's Intangibles collection, a selection of artworks without physical form sold through the Walker's gift shop. Disappear With Me cost $100, and there were only three for sale. Soth would send each purchaser images through the Snapchat social media app.
25 pictures minimum.
The images would come one at a time, and the recipient was expected to send an image in reply. A single Alex Soth print can cost thousands, so 25 images for $100 is a great deal. Of course, as Snapchat users know, recipients can only view what they get for a maximum of 10 seconds. Then the images disappear.
So you kind of had to be present, you know, for it. Otherwise, you'd blink and you'd miss it.
Brian Goldston was one of the three buyers. After working in the tech industry, he now describes himself as beginning a career as a creator of storytelling contraptions, things he says are more likely to appear in the virtual world than the physical. He learned about Disappear With Me through an article in the New York Times and leapt at the chance.
Part of that was the disappearingness of it. I think in particular because I'm middle-aged right now and I'm thinking a lot about life and transience.
Goldston described the experience as like a blind date where he didn't know the rules. However, he quickly learned. He calls some of the images he received show-stopping, and he took pleasure in deciding what to send back. He says while it was remarkable to be exchanging images with Soth, it wasn't necessarily because he was a celebrated photographer.
I found it actually more profound that he was just this person doing this.
Soth also says he found powerful moments of interaction.
With so much photography out in the world, it's kind of like with so much music out in the world. Sometimes you need that live experience, that thing that's fleeting, in order to focus on it and cherish it.
However, Goldston says he found it so profound, he told Soth he felt he'd been undercharged. He wanted to make a donation to pay it forward. Soth told Goldston about his next project, the Winnebago Workshop. He's changing his publishing house, called Little Brown Mushroom, into an educational venture. He wants to work with teenagers to create live, image-driven events. He's taking applications till next Monday, looking for a group of 16 to 18-year-olds interested in photography, drawing, and writing. They'll travel in his RV to a place to gather stories and then present them as a live show in that place.
This application form is really more about finding, you know, quirky people that have an interest in poking around out in the world.
Soth plans to make the workshops a regular thing with the help of a Knight Foundation Challenge grant. It awarded him $35,000 for the project, money which he has to match through fundraising. Goldston's donation is a start. Soth describes the project as a way of pushing forward in an insanely fast digital world. However, the Knight Foundation's Nicole Chippy sees it as old school too, an artist working within a community with the support of that community.
It's giving the audience and giving the community the power to say, this is the kind of art that is important to me, this is the kind of art I want to have in my community.
Which is in itself an artistic collaboration. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News update for the week and the month. I'm Phil Picardi, back Monday with the Minnesota News. And a reminder, starting Thursday, you can get the Minnesota News on the new The Ticker podcast.